Our first case is case number 68090, Macarena Partida versus State. Ms. Butko for the appellant, Ms. Noble for the respondent. Ms. Butko, you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, Justice.
Do you want to reserve any time? You did file a report.
5 minutes, please. Justices, counsel. This is an appeal from a denial of post-conviction, and it has virtually every procedural quagmire that we could see occurring in a criminal post-conviction case. So first we have what is an illegal sentence, and it is imposed by the district court. It's important to look at the pre-sentence investigation as a starting point, because it recommends concurrent sentences on all three counts. The key count in the case is a battery with intent to commit sexual assault with the use of a deadly weapon, which was a knife that was found inside the residence. So then the other two counts are a burglary and a home invasion, which arise from the same set of facts where Mr. Partida entered the home through a basement window that he broke.
Okay. Ms. Buck, I was trying to go through the math and all after reading this, but the original sentence on counts one and two, count one was 96 months, then the enhancement. That was the same on the resentence on count. Count two was 48 to 120, and then 26 to 60 on the enhancement. And the resentence on count two was reduced and no enhancement. Count three, I think, is the problem. You know, it was 24 to 60 on the primary offense, and then with an enhancement. But the primary offense was raised to 33 to 84. Is that the primary crux of your argument?
It is. And in essence, if we look at the sentence as it stood, we would have had a life with 96 and a 48 to 120 on count one. Mm-hmm. And Judge Freeman made sure he said that count stands and this is not a resentencing on that. So that count was standing. Then counts two and three, count two was going to be a 48 to 120 and then a consecutive 24 to 60 for the deadly weapon. Then count three was running concurrent to count two. So in reality, he would never have done as much time as he's going to do now with the count three running consecutive. And I do think it's important to know that the pre-sentence report did recommend all three sentences run concurrent. The pre-sentence report contained the mistake
that the judge is not bound by that pre-sentence report. It's just a recommendation. Is that not correct?
That's correct. But it gives you guidance as to what the headset is when they go to sentencing. And I think Judge Walker, when he did the second sentencing, he made it very clear that he thought the home invasion and the burglary were pretty much tied together as the same act, even though there is a different element in the home invasion by the breaking of the window. And so he made it clear that he was running those concurrent because he thought they were intertwined. So that's, I think, one of the key parts of the case. And I do think that the sentence that came out, I mean, I'm troubled by the fact that I could not file the appeal prior to accepting the remedy of a resentencing, because I think that the petitioner had a right to have his post-conviction issues heard, and the question of whether a resentencing was a remedy or striking the offensive enhancements. Because under Nevada law, what should have happened when I said this is an illegal sentence, under Dolby and Wilson, the court should have taken it back and stricken the deadly weapon enhancements, which were imposed as a 193-165 enhancement, and just stricken them. Had they done that, then my client would have had life with 96, 48 to 120, and then the burglary and other running concurrent, so he got 48 to 120, and it would have come out extremely better than the remedy that was granted by the district court, which in essence, I felt like I should walk in the door backward. In essence, I won post-conviction relief only to lose two more time. So he exercises his constitutional rights to tell the judge, this is an illegal sentence, and in return, he gets more time. So that's one of the keys of the case.
Okay. I think we understand your position on that. How about some of these other issues?
NRS 200.400 is a statute that leaves us with a lot of concern. The sentence says 2 years minimum to a maximum of life in prison. And so there's no guidance there. A person committing battery with intent to commit sexual assault could easily get a sentence more harsh and more severe than someone who does a sexual assault or does a top-level kidnapping. If we look at the statutes that are in place, this client got close to a sentence for second-degree murder. He got almost the same sentence as if he had committed the rape, almost the same sentence as if he had done a first-level kidnapping. And when we look at the sentence that was imposed, the statute reads very vague, 2 years to life. And the state brought up the DUI law, which I thought was very an interesting argument, as an analogy. But if we take that law as an analogy, every day in the felony DUI world, we see them honor the Truth in Sentencing Act of 95. We see the 40-60 split. So if someone's going to get the 240 on a DUI harm case, they're going to get 96 on the bottom. You know what you're going to get. When with 200.400, you have no idea what you're going to get. You could get life with 50. You could get life with 20. You could treat it as a murder case instead of as, it's a serious crime and they're tough facts. I don't discount that.
Well, DUI with substantial bodily harm or death is 2 to 20, right?
Exactly.
So I think I've had some experience with that with multiple deaths and one case. You know, Justice Douglas and I both had that case. So this range in the sentence is astronomical, especially if you have multiple injuries or deaths involved in it.
So, oh, exactly.
So but you feel it's not analogous to the DUI with substantial injury or death?
If we take that approach, then the 96 that he got should equate to 240 on the top instead of life. I think that the state wants it both ways, and that's my problem with that statute. If he gets a 96 on the bottom, then he should get the 60% run on the top, and he'd get 240 instead of life. If he's going to get life, and we're going to say life and the minimum is 2, then we're going to treat it like the sex assault statutes, the lewdness statutes, rather than like the DUI statute. Then we're going to call it life with 2. But to do this split on this statute doesn't make sense. I think it leaves a sentencing judge in a quandary of what should I do? Can I do anything I want? And I did have a case out in the world where the judge gave my client 50 with 20. And that's the same sentence you get for first-degree murder.
Isn't this an issue for the legislature rather than us, though, as to the sentencing?
Well, I guess it depends on whether you consider the statute constitutional or whether you consider the wording used in that statute to be vague and unable to be determined by differing sentencing judges. If you determine that a judge in Washoe County versus a judge in Lyon County versus...
Well, would you prefer to have something like the federal guidelines where it's just a grid box where you go up and over and that's it?
I would never want to. I've done those. Never want to.
Discretion away, and I realize.
Get ready, because we have a sentencing commission that's recommended that, so get ready. And we'll get ready, because we'll have upward departures and downward departures.
Because I was with the federal system. I know how tough that's going
to
be. Get
well,
ready.
I have to say,
that's attorneys and DAs.
I do okay over there, but it's harder fought, trust me. And sentencings take 2-3 days. They don't take 20 minutes. So I think when we look at that statute, I'm uncomfortable with the wording. I'm uncomfortable with the lack of guidance given to the sentencing judges. And I think that they easily can misinterpret it and they can apply it any way they want to.
Well, it's a difficult argument you're attempting to make, because at one point it's almost like you're opting for no discretion for the judge, but by the same time you're also asking for discretion on the judge looking at the individual and their background and the particular crime. So how do you balance the two?
Well, and I would go back to the position, if the judge thought that this case was worth 96 months, then he should do the math and use the Truth in Sentencing law that we passed in 95, and he should say, if I'm going to give you 96, I'm not going to give you life, I'm going to give you 240. But if he really thinks, I want them to monitor you for life, then the statute says 2 is the minimum. The life is a huge sanction.
As Justice Cherry pointed out, the legislature saw fit to put on the top end the ability to give life.
And this changed in 2005. I went back and did the history. From 95 to 2005, this law stood as a 2 to 15. And regularly, we saw 2 to 15. We didn't see a 2 to 6 or a 6 to 15. We saw a 2 to 15.
The building next door who creates these ranges determined that.
And as long as you believe that our judges won't impermissibly impose this. And I can tell you, they could give life with 50. They could say, Mr. Partita, what you did is horrible.
Well, I'll tell you, Ms. Becca, it's a frustrating thing for us because we see cases maybe out of the rurals where the judges really pile it on. In Clark County, they would give them probably the minimum. So for the same case, it just depends on the judge and all. The problem is the case law says we really can't interfere, the judges have the discretion to do the sentencing, and the ultimate correcting point is the pardons board, because that pardons board can reduce it, but as Justice Sherry pointed out, we're kind of in a box, unless it's a constitutional violation like you've argued in this case.
Right.
And I, as a former defense attorney, whenever the minimum is two, who cares what the maximum is? Because that's what you use to negotiate. You say, no problem with the heavy duty on the top end. It's the bottom end you got to worry about. That's when the eligibility parole comes, and maybe you'll have a longer tail, but you'll be out of prison quicker. So this is damned if you do and damned if you don't for us as judges to try to interfere with what the legislature has done or what the people who have DA's Association and the Nevada Attorneys for Criminal Justice have tried to do with sentencing. Right now, as long as it's in the as long as the sentence is in the range, we usually don't disturb it.
Well, hopefully you'll consider my vagueness issue, and I'll reserve the rest of my
time. Okay, you have 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Ms. Noble, tell us about the sentencing on this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And welcome to the Supreme Court.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Jennifer Noble. I represent the state in this matter. And I want to begin just very briefly, Justice Terry, before I get into that, by just answering one comment that Ms. Butko made in her argument, and that was that this defendant received almost the same sentence that he would have received if he had committed rape. I just want to remind the Court, I know the Court's aware of the facts of this case, that but for this victim fighting for her life and her body, that indeed is what could have happened. She was faced with a man who jumped out of her closet with a knife. He had duct tape. He put his hands around her throat. He forced her onto the bed. She got away from him or got him to run away. But there's a good reason for the sentences being close, because that was definitely his intent, as the jury found. Now, on to the sentencing argument. I would concede that Dolby is our hurdle here. In this case, we have two cases where we're discussing in the briefs Dolby and Wilson. Now, in the Dolby case, the court acknowledges that when a sentence is unlawful, there's not a double jeopardy problem vacating or modifying that sentence. They acknowledge that when you're forced to vacate an unlawful sentence, you can't increase the sentence on a separate count. And that is in line with the federal cases cited in that opinion. But then it takes that and extends it to a single count that happens to have an enhancement. And in doing that, the court relied on the Bowen decision. In the Bowen decision, that court was talking about things like calculation of parole, pre-sentence credits, good time credits, and that was the focus of that opinion. There is language that says it should be treated that way for all purposes at the end of Bowen.
So let's talk about count three. Originally, it's 24 to 60 and 24 to 60, and it ran concurrent to counts one and two. Now, count three was increased to 33 to 84 with no enhancement run consecutive. I didn't think you could do that as a district judge. Tell me why I'm wrong. I thought it had to be, it could not be higher in total time, at least than it was in the original sentence.
If this court continues to apply Dolby the way it's been applied, the answer to your question is yes, you're correct. But what I'd like the court to consider is, since Dolby was decided, we've had some changes in the statute providing for enhancements. In 2007, which is after Dolby and actually after Wilson, the court went from the like sentencing requirement, where the base sentence and the enhancement had to match, to giving the judges more discretion. Now it can be a 1 to 20 for the enhancement. Now we can have, the court is in fact required to enumerate various factors that it's considering. Discretion is given to the court, and it's become much more complex. Now, I would ask the court, to some extent, to revisit Dolby's application only insofar as it says that you cannot resentence or change the base sentence when you have an aggravating or an enhancement that's applied improperly.
Counsel, don't we have a proposition out of the federal court, the guideline in Kennedy, in terms of we cannot, in essence, vacate lawful sentences, and we can't sentence them for more than they were originally sentenced for on resentencing?
That's correct, Your Honor. But what I'm asking is that the court consider the base sentence and the enhancement as part of one sentence.
Wouldn't we have to overrule Dolby to do that?
I think you would have to apply Dolby in a little bit of a different way and acknowledge that we've had some changes in the statutory scheme since then. And to be clear, the state is not asking for the court to all of a sudden accept the sentencing package doctrine that the federal courts...
Don't we have another blemish to deal with, and that is once someone has been sentenced, there's a certain prohibition, opposed to someone who has not been sentenced?
That's correct, Your Honor, unless the sentence is an unlawful sentence. And so
we have to hold on to the lawful portions thereof. And in essence, so the U.S. Supreme Court has basically said, look, once that jeopardy attaches because you have sentenced them, you're bound within that rubric to stay there. You are not allowed to, as Justice Sherry would say, upward depart, so to speak.
Yes, but what the state is asking for is for you to consider this all one sentence, one unlawful sentence. And I'd like you to consider this. There's a good reason for this. In this case, the jury found that this defendant used a weapon in the commission of these crimes. He had a knife. Now, the state made an error in its charging document. And for that reason, the enhancement is now illegal and we have to fix it. That count is illegal in terms of the way the sentencing has been applied. But if we simply strike that count and don't allow the judge, who, by the way, Ms. Lutko stated that it was Judge Walker who also did the resentencing, it was Judge Freeman, we're asking Judge Freeman to completely ignore that element of the case. In other words, he can't even consider something that the jury has already decided beyond a reasonable doubt occurred. It was one of the findings that they made. So now he's having to administer a sentence in a vacuum. And by the way, there may be an issue, to some extent, of waiver, because at sentencing, Ms. Butko requested that count two be reduced. So if the situation is that we cannot touch the base count, if that's the argument, why are we now reducing that count?
Well, I guess here's my concern. All three of us are district judges. We did, between the three, probably did 1,000 sentences, or probably that's probably understating it. I can't remember how many robberies we did. We have to, when we were district judges, we had to double them up because of the use of the deadly weapon. We didn't want to, but we had to under the circumstances here. It wasn't my understanding when they changed the enhancements. I thought they were, what they were trying to do is saying the enhancements where you automatically doubled everything with the use of the deadly weapon was too much. They wanted to give the judges some discretion to make it lower than a doubling, but there wasn't any desire that I'm aware of in the legislature to reduce the base sentence on, let's say, something like robbery. Am I wrong, or can you explain to me what happened? I was in the Supreme Court by the time this law had changed, but so I didn't really follow it that close, but if you can enlighten me on what the history was of that, I'd be interested in it.
Well, in terms of the history, it's just my understanding that I believe in 2005, it's changed from the life sentencing to giving the courts more discretion and requiring they enumerate those factors on the record, I believe. But part of what made me think about this argument is the Wilson case, where the court talks about, hey, we're not going to embrace the federal sentencing approach, this package doctrine, because we're nowhere near as complex. And so the state's argument with respect to that is that since the deciding of Dolby, since the deciding of Wilson, it has become more complex with respect to these enhancements. And so perhaps it would be appropriate to revisit Dolby only in the sense that it relies so heavily on the Bowen case in terms of essentially treating the enhancement and the base sentence as completely separate counts. And of course, in the Wilson case, what went wrong is not only did the judge merge the counts as he was ordered to do, but then he went into the unchallenged counts and ran those consecutive, and certainly we concede that is the wrong thing to do under our laws. Essentially, the defendant's benefited already. He's had a windfall from an error in the charging document, and now the court, the new sentencing court, if we follow Dolby and apply it as it's continued to be applied, now can't even consider the fact that the knife was used during the perpetration of these crimes.
What about the constitutional argument Ms. Butko made under NRS 200.400?
Yes, sir. With respect to that, the state would say that the plain language of that statute says, quote, imprisonment in the state prison for a minimum term of not less than 2 years and a maximum term of life with the possibility of parole. The urged interpretation by Ms. Butko would basically ignore clearly expressed statutory language and deprive it of its force. Why would we have minimum term of not less than 2 years if what the statute means to say is 2 years to life? That's not what it says. And it is to some extent analogous to the DUI statute, and the state would continue to advance that argument. In fact, I believe in 2005 or so, 200.400 was revised from 2 to 15, just like some of the DUI statutes read, to not a minimum term of not less than 2 years to life.
See, if I was a lobbyist for the defense bar, I'd be real careful about going to the legislature to try to change that statute, because that too will go up. There's no doubt in my mind when they hear facts like if you were presenting from the District Attorney's Association as to this case with the knife and everything and the resistance, it would no longer be 2 to life, it would be something else, maybe the 50, which doesn't really help the defendants as far as incarceration. So I just wanted to make that known. That we've been told there was a justice. Justice Rose always thought that maybe we should look at whether there's been some type of clear error by the judge in sentencing. But what the case law is in this state, as long as it's in the statutory framework, we don't touch it. You know, it's up to the judge. We give our district judges discretion on sentencing when there's a minimum and a maximum.
Certainly, and with respect to the 40% rule concern that was raised, well, what's 40% of life? It's tough to know, but we know that our legislature has determined, for example, with the sex assault on the child statute, that 35 to life is an acceptable sentence. So I certainly think in this case, as applied, 8 years to life is not unconstitutional, and it would be premature for this court to even consider that, because the way this is applied, it's clearly a reasonable sentence given the facts of this case.
Well, I'm just thinking, in, let's say second degree murder, you could get, let's say without use of a deadly weapon, is that 10 to life, I think, is the sentence on that, or the range. So you can have a life tail for that. I'm just trying to think of other, you know, all these sexual assault cases usually have life jails, as I recall.
Yes, that's true. And so I think there's a strong argument to be made that the statutory language clearly contemplates a minimum term of 2 years, but you're not limited to exactly 2 years. If that's what they meant, they would have written it that way. That's the state's argument with respect to that. I'd also like to point out, if I may, jumping back to the first argument, in the Dolby case, we have an unlawful enhancement that was applied because of the age of the victim, right? So 10 years plus 10 years was the original sentence, and then the judge, when he's forced to resentence, goes, okay, 20 years. Okay, that's not what Judge Freeman did in this case. And it's certainly not what, and if we compare the facts of the Wilson case, again, very different. This judge clearly considered the facts of this case, understood the enhancements no longer applied, and actually listened to all the evidence or all the arguments at sentencing, including mitigation information that was presented by Ms. Butko, and he actually reduced count 2. So in this case, we don't have a judge that's simply trying to match the original sentence or somehow penalize the defendant for seeking relief. In this case, we have, and everyone I believe concedes this, that the aggregate sentence for this defendant is less in a significant way at the top and the bottom after this resentencing. Alternatively, I would request that if the court is disinclined or is not persuaded by my argument with respect to Dolby and its application here, that on remand or on resentencing, the court be permitted to just reinstate the original base sentences, so that 48 to 120 months on count 2 and leaving 24 to 60. If we're going to just simply strike the enhancements, then certainly I don't think it's just to leave the change of the base sentences.
If so, you're saying if we declare the second sentence invalid, you can go back to the first, even though it's higher in parts, you know, it's okay to do that then?
Yes, because if the ruling is, no, what you do at resentencing is you just simply strike those enhancements, then that should be what happens. Does the court have any other questions for me? I know there were 6 or 5 issues presented in this case. I'm certainly happy to address any of them.
I think there's no further questions. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ms. Brito, rebuttal?
Thank you. I want to remind the court that this began as an ineffective assistance of counsel case. And the way that Judge Freeman issued his order, there was never a ruling on ineffective assistance of counsel. There was a ruling that there was no prejudice and a new sentencing on 2 counts. But clearly, it's interesting to be in my shoes because regularly I get called things like pond scum and bottom feeder, and people ask me why I do what I do. And why I do what I do is because you had 100 years of experience in the courtroom on the first sentencing. 100 years. You have DAs and chief judges. These folks have a lot of time in. And you have an absolutely illegal sentence missed by the appellate attorney as well. And when I read it, I go, this is absolutely a legal sentence. There's no question. So it's very simple for me that the remedy is that of striking the illegal portions of the sentence. And once we do that, we strike the deadly weapon enhancements, and we run the two second counts concurrent. And I thought it would be very simple. Except what we had was a judge who demanded a resentencing. And he agreed with me he had to have a resentencing. I objected to a resentencing. The state just told you I waived this issue by doing the sentencing. I didn't waive anything. On the sentencing date, I complained, I don't want to do this. I want your clerk to enter the order so I can appeal this. And Judge Freeman said, Ms. Buckley, you're not waiving anything. We're going to sentencing today. Get ready. So off to sentencing we went. I didn't get to appeal the basics of my post-conviction case. I had to go to a new sentence. At the new sentencing, we did produce additional mitigation evidence. We produced the fact he was doing well in prison, he was working, he was getting an education, and his family members were in court. In spite of that, he got a harsher sentence than he got the first time. And on top of that, the state at that second sentencing argument asked the court to give respect to Judge Walker's sentence. So basically, the state asked the judge, if you're going to do a new sentencing, the state asked the judge to violate Dolby and make the counts adjust so that it comes out to the same amount of time, which is inherently what Judge Freeman did. The sentence is illegal. So I wouldn't concede that the sentence imposed as stands is less. It isn't. It's not going to be served as less. It's going to be served as 3 terms in front of a parole board. That's harsh. It's not going to be served less. It's going to be served more. The other thing I wanted to point out is that 205060 (1) was the charging document on this case. There was no subsection 4 cited. So there wasn't even a deadly weapon enhancement in front of the court on the first sentencing to dish out a deadly weapon enhancement. He was not charged with burglary with a weapon. The language of the count said it, but the statute charging the document was the generic burglary statute. There wasn't a weapon added to that. There was a weapon added to the home invasion count. That was charged out properly under the statute as the weapon. So I think when the court looks at this, I guess it's a remedy issue. What's the remedy when the sentence is illegal? And you do have direct case law. The Wilson case is a 2007 case. It's directly on point. The Dolby case is really hard to distinguish from this setting because you have 3 enhancements on 3 crimes. But the statutes specifically talk about how those enhancements play. It goes from a 1 to 10 to a 2 to 15 instead of a second illegal enhancement under 193-165. So I think the bottom line is the court has to issue a remedy. I'd ask you to go back and look at the fact that this is an ineffective assistance case. And, you know, the rules are a little different if we say that the sentencing was ineffective. What's the remedy? And I would submit.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Court thanks Ms. Noble, Ms. Butko, for your spirited and professional arguments in this matter. This case will stand submitted and will be in recess until 11:30. Or if the parties are ready, maybe we'll start a little earlier, Ms. Cummings. We'll be in recess. Thank you very much, and have a happy holidays to everybody. Thanks.